This podcast is brought to you by Upcase. Improve your development skills by completing coding exercises that are peer-reviewed by real humans. Learn more at upcase.com.
Hello and welcome to Reboot, where we talk about taking leaps and switching careers. I'm Adarsh Pandit, a developer here at Thoughtbot in San Francisco. I arrived here after previous careers in management consulting and academic science. On the show, I'll be talking with other people who've made similar big career changes and how they've done it. In episode 1 of our first season, we'll talk with Gordon Fontenot, an iOS developer here at Thoughtbot, about his career path moving from college dropout to bartender to film editor. So I just want to start with a bit of warm-up. Tell me, I guess, what you do now for work.
So I'm an iOS developer here at Thoughtbot.
And how long have you been doing it?
2 years next Wednesday.
Oh, congratulations in advance.
Thank you.
What did you do immediately before this?
Immediately before this, I was doing film editing for about 6 years.
Wow. And how did you get into that?
I was living in Texas. So I'm from Texas originally, and I was waiting tables and bartending and had kind of dropped out of college and trying to make paychecks, you know?
Yeah. What were you studying originally in college?
General studies.
Nice.
So if you want to go, back farther. So I did some programming stuff when I was in high school, right? Yeah. I screwed around on the web doing some JavaScript, never got real serious, bought a bunch of books, didn't understand them.
What books did you buy?
The JavaScript, O'Reilly JavaScript books.
JavaScript, the good parts?
No, like the big tome looking ones. Mm-hmm. And I was like trying to read through those and not good. I took a programming class in high school. This is like a little town in the middle of nowhere, so we were just like doing QBasic, that kind of stuff. But never got real serious with it. Thought it was fun, but never really took it that seriously. So I went to college. I applied to UT, and I didn't get into UT. I got into they have this program where they'll send you to one of their satellite schools, right?
Mm-hmm.
And if you have a 3.0 GPA and 30 hours inside 2 semesters, then you get automatic acceptance for your sophomore year into the main campus, which is a great deal. And it's designed specifically to weed people like me out of the system, right? Because I got into college and I just did not do well in that environment. And I didn't do well at that college. And so I ended up, you know, I was there for 3 semesters and kind of dropped out. But I had gone for general studies with kind of this vague idea that maybe I would do something with technology later. But I was never, again, I just, nothing was serious at that point in my life. Like I had
Did it even seem like a plausible job at that point?
I don't know. It didn't seem real. You know what I mean? It seemed like this idea of a job.
Yeah.
But I had no idea what the job would mean, what the job would entail. Like it was this kind of like vague concept of a job, but I never really spent time thinking about it. I did a lot of tech stuff. Like I built, you know, my own PCs in college.
And so more hardware.
I guess, but like physically putting together, you know, buying stuff on Amazon and then assembling it in my dorm room. That's, you know what I mean? It's not like I got into soldering or I never got into any electrical engineering stuff. I never got into the programming stuff. I just kind of, it was like expensive Legos. Basically.
Yeah. I mean, that's fellow Texan Michael Dell got his start that way.
Right.
You could have been Michael Dell.
I could have been this close.
I did something similar. I was building like PC clones when I was in high school and for other people. And they basically were happy to get IBM PC clones at like a third of the price. But then I don't know if you have this experience, you end up fixing them constantly.
Yeah, constantly. Yeah, they break and I feel bad. And, you know, it's a bad idea.
Yeah.
In retrospect. So then I end up dropping out of college and I'm waiting tables and bartending and just trying to make rent and decided that I just had to make a big change in my life. Like I was just kind of like circling the drain, so to speak. You know, it was just a crappy relationship and in a crappy place financially and just bad all around. So I decided that I had to make a big change and I decided that what I needed to do is I needed to get out of Texas. Like that was set in my head was like, if I can just get as far away from here as possible, then my life will get as far away from here as possible. That kind of thing.
Interesting.
So I started thinking about it and like over this course of time, I was buying DVDs constantly. Like that's honestly where almost all of my money in that period of time where I was like in and around college, I was just buying DVDs.
Just because you're a film buff or you're a collector? Both?
Kind of a little bit of both. I love movies. I loved movies at that point. I just wanted to see every movie, and I wanted to own everything that I was watching. So I was just constantly buying movies, constantly looking for new movies to buy.
What are your genres of choice?
Westerns. Huge fan of Westerns. Sci-fi a bit, but not real deep into it. And then just kind of drama stuff. I've always liked kind of cerebral drama kind of movies. But so as I'm sitting in San Antonio, Texas, kind of having trouble making enough money to eat consistently and having this idea of like, well, I just have to leave. And also trying to think about like, well, what am I going to, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to wait table. I never want to wait tables again. That was like a big goal too, right? Mm-hmm. So I said, you know, I love film. Like, why don't I just go into film?
Sure.
And that was an easy jump. And he was like, oh, this makes sense. And so I started looking at schools. My mom is actually from Massachusetts, from around the Boston area. And there was a school that I found, my dad found actually, in Waltham, Massachusetts, which is about 10 miles west of Boston, for film. It was like all digital films, a 10-month program. It's not, you know, they're a part of Boston University, but it wasn't.
Main campus.
This school's actually gone now. They've gone bankrupt. Turns out it was run by a bunch of crooks and whatnot. But at the time, it was a decent school. And so,
did it seem weird to you that you had kind of decided earlier that like a general formal education wasn't what worked for you, but then a more specific like, I guess I'm wondering, as you approach this, you're coming at this with education again, right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to like just doing the job.
Yeah, and that's a constant theme with me, honestly,
I think it's a constant theme with a lot of people. Like,
yeah.
I think as you start to think about different jobs, education seems like the road in.
Right. So my thing with college, the reason I didn't do well at college had nothing to do with like intelligence level or like my ability to do the work. It was flat out interest. I am not good at feigning interest in things that I don't have an interest in. So like I took freshman English every semester that I was in college, I took freshman English. The first one, like one, you know, whatever the first, just because like I just never did the homework. And I always was just like, well, maybe I'll get a D that like I was just trying to pass it enough to get out of there. You know what I mean? Like yeah. I you know, I went to bartending school while I was in college and I studied way more for those tests than I ever did. One of my roommate was in my same English class, and I remember once him making fun of me because I was literally – we had a test that day in English, and I was sitting outside the room studying like flashcards of drink recipes. Yeah, because I had a test in that. And he was like, what the hell are you doing? Like you have a test in this in like 10 minutes, and this actually matters. But again, I don't find English interesting enough to study. I found that bartending, for whatever reason, I found it interesting enough to study. Mm-hmm. So dropping out of college made total sense to me because I couldn't get myself excited about going through the two plus years of auxiliary stuff that you have to do in order to get to the stuff that you actually wanted to learn.
Do you think you could have got a bartending job without having gone to bartending school?
Yeah. It had no effect in me ending up. I was like a bartender at Chili's. It's not like I was some high-end bartender. It's just that they promoted me from a waiter. You know what I mean? Like bartending school had nothing to do with anything else in the rest of my life. I've forgotten almost all that stuff. This is not, you know.
They have squiggly straws. I mean, there's a lot of there's art to be had there.
Sure. I just think it's indicative of kind of my attitude towards education as a whole, right? Like sitting outside English class, studying the thing that interests me but ultimately doesn't matter, to the detriment of the studying the thing that matters but doesn't interest me.
Yeah, you know completely. I mean, I don't think that you can do a good job at anything if you don't have passion or interest in it.
Right.
Like I was doing a job in the pharmaceutical industry and, you know, I had the daily emails of here's what's been approved and here's what's going through this clinical trial, and I just didn't care. I had to force myself to read it. It was like eating paste. But then I would read like TechCrunch and Mashable and All Things D and be super psyched about it.
Yeah.
I think everybody has to have passion and interest to be able to do a good job.
Yes. Yeah. No, absolutely. So, you know, going back to school made sense in my head because when I'm going back to this school, this 10-month program, it's very clear that I'm just going to spend 40 hours a week learning film. I'm like, perfect. That's exactly what I want to do. I don't want to waste my time with all this other stuff. What I want to learn is the real skills that are interesting to me and the real things that are going to help me do the thing that I want to do. So I literally, like, I rented an apartment in Waltham off Craigslist, sight unseen, for, how much was it? It was like $800 a month, which was the cheapest thing I could find, and it was relatively close to the school. And I threw all of my stuff in a U-Haul trailer, and me and my dad just drove up 3 days. So it's like January 20th, we leave Texas, right? So I'm in my hometown on January 19th, sitting in the back of my buddy's truck, like in shorts and a t-shirt, drinking a beer. And then 3 days later, we show up in Massachusetts in the middle of a blizzard. Like,
this is like an American dream kind of story.
Yeah, it was
an early West settler.
Yeah, exactly.
Just like delving into the unknown West.
Exactly.
Having no idea what to do, not having any idea if you're going to survive.
Yeah, that's it exactly. I signed a 10-month lease. I was only supposed to be in Massachusetts for 10 months. My idea was to come up here, go to film school, learn this, and then do something. Whether I wasn't going to stay in Massachusetts, but it was going to be maybe I move back to Texas. That was always a thing that was in my head. Maybe I move to the West Coast. I don't know. You know, it was just like,
let's focus on this step now.
Exactly.
And then worry about the next step later. But knowing that then this current step will enable you to have broader choices.
Absolutely. I go to the film school and I do okay. I was a decent shooter. You know, I was a decent camera op, horrible writer, really good technically at the editing, right? Like I took to the editing software very, very well and had very strong technical affinity for the software that we were using. And I think I was a good aesthetic editor as well, personally. But, like, I don't know. I was always better at the tech than I was probably the aesthetics around it. So, you know, needless to say, like, I haven't left Massachusetts since. I haven't left Waltham since. I've been in Waltham
Never. Like, you work remotely from Waltham.
No. I mean, you know, I haven't moved out of Waltham. The closest I got was moving to North Waltham, which, you know, could be a different town, but isn't. But I've just been there for like 8 years now. Right out of film school, I got a job at the school as a TA. Again, I was kind of in this broke situation and got a job as a TA just kind of randomly. I was actually stopping off there on my way to like Blockbuster to see if they would give me a job just because I needed some money coming in. And one of my old teachers was like, hey, do you want to come on as a TA?
So when you finish school, mm-hmm. are they helping you to interview? And like, are you now thinking about like what industries do I want to work in and where is the best place for that? And what are the kind of jobs I can get?
Yeah. I spent a lot of time. There's a company called Central Booking here in Massachusetts, which is literally just like, one dude in an office at a audio video rental facility, and he basically runs I have no idea if it's like this anymore, but he basically ran the film industry in Boston. Like anybody coming to town would go through him. That's where they'd hire shooters or, you know, assistant directors, grips, whatever, people to work on set. So I signed up with Central Booking, shelling out however much that was a month, you know, to get referrals. I did a few jobs. So I ended up getting a full-time job at the school as a TA and doing some freelance stuff on the side. Moved from the TA job into a job where I was doing a lot of marketing videos for the school. And that's actually, I started getting back into programming that early. So that was like five years ago.
Is it the editing software and kind of what that's tickling that's starting to get you back into programming?
It was automation, honestly. It was seeing inefficiencies in my workflow and wanting to fix those inefficiencies through automation. Mm-hmm. So like an example is like I had an Apple script that I had wrote. It was a lot of Apple script that I was writing at this point. So I wrote this Apple script to I'd hit render, right, on a video. So I'd edit a video and I'd hit render, and I was using Avid at the time. So this little modal window would pop up like with a progress bar, and then I'd start this script, and the script would check every second. I think it would check the view hierarchy in Avid to see if that little modal window existed, and as soon as it checked and didn't find it, it would switch over to Skype and send me a text message through Skype to let me know that my render is done. So that meant I could hit render, and the renders would take, you know, these were renders that were taking like 30 minutes long because I was doing a bunch of graphics work or whatever. So I'd hit like render, and I'd just go across the street and hang out at the bar. Or you know, go walk around and hang out, talk to friends in the equipment room, or just do whatever, just do anything else.
Not sit there
and stare at a screen. And then all of a sudden I get a text message and it's like, your render is done. It's like, oh, cool. And then I go back and do that. And so that kind of ballooned into heavier scripting things. Like I wrote a script for the school that to generate all their user IDs, because the person that was creating all the user IDs, like literally the physical cards that you would carry around, got fired. And she was doing it all by hand in Photoshop, just like dropping stuff in.
Sure.
And I was like, well, that's stupid. It's like, I can do this. So I spent like a week. No one knew where my office was. So no one had any kind of idea what I was doing back in this office
by the way. If you can ever have an office where no one knows where you are.
It's the best. Ugh. Yeah. I was like back underneath this staircase, you know what I mean? Like in this random building. Like no one knew. A lot of people knew that I worked at the school. No one knew what I did.
Yeah. No one knew. You're literally the person under the stairs.
Yeah. So since that was the case, like it gave me a lot of time to experiment and play around with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote the script that scripted Photoshop in conjunction, you know, took a folder of photos and a CSV generated from them, the student database, and joined that data together in Photoshop in a template file and then shot that off to a printer. So it took it used to take this other lady like 2 weeks, no, 2 months to get student IDs out, and they could have them out like next day after, so I wrote this thing and I actually ended up selling it to them, which was fairly shady on my part, but I ended up selling it to them, and they used it for years, this Apple script that just continued to keep working.
Now, at this point, do you feel like a programmer?
No, not at all.
You're just
a
guy who's kind of hacking around and just cutting corners and automating things wherever you can.
Right. I knew that what I was doing seemed like magic to pretty much everyone I knew, but I didn't consider it as being real, period. You know what I mean? I thought it was just kind of this goofy, you know, AppleScript is such a weird language. It doesn't feel like you're really doing anything anyway. I don't know. I had this idea in my head that since I wasn't creating anything new, since all these things that I was doing, all they were doing, they were adding glue layers between other people's software, that what I was doing wasn't actual development work.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Which isn't entirely true.
Right. Now, where are you in terms of frustration with where you wanted to be and what you were aiming to do and kind of how much you're enjoying working at the school and kind of taking gigs here and there?
Really, really frustrated. My film career just wasn't moving in the direction that I thought I was going to move in. I wasn't doing anything that I was proud of. The freelance jobs that I was getting just weren't living up to my expectations, and there weren't a whole bunch of them, and it wasn't like all of a sudden I was, you know, on set every day, hanging out with fun people, doing interesting things. It was just like this very big kind of like letdown. I ended up leaving that job and I got a full-time job as an editor at a company even further west, editing basically car review videos. So like little 1 minute to 3 minute long videos on a specific year make model of a car with some voiceover. And I stayed there for 4 years, and that's probably what really kind of burned me out in the film industry, because it was very much a factory line kind of thing. You know what I mean? It was every single month we were doing, if you were in charge of the 2 minute video, you were doing 15 of them. If you were in charge of the 1 minute video, you were doing 30 of them every month, every single month, just every day, just cranking out as many of these as you can. And they were very formulaic and it got to be the point where you could edit these without thinking.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And it's lacking in this, what appears to be like a creative element, which is 100%. Something that you're aiming for.
100%. Yeah. You know, I had a boss that was very overbearing, very micromanaged everything. We had offices, which I insisted upon all the, I ended up very quickly becoming the senior editor just because the guy ahead of me quit. So all of a sudden I'm the most senior person on the staff. And I insisted that editors have their own space because you don't really want to edit with headphones. You want to be editing with speakers if you're doing. I wanted us to be doing things the right way.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard, particularly when you get into those comfortable roles, because you have a regular job, right? And you're sort of advancing within that job. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I had this happen to me a couple of times where I'm like, I'd be crazy to do something different, right? Yep. Like I'm getting paid and I have benefits and healthcare and...
Yep.
You know, why would I do something different? I don't know if you had the same experience.
Absolutely. And I kept getting promoted and I kept getting raises and I kept getting more responsibility. And I didn't like enjoy any of it, you know, except for the extra money. You know, every time I got a raise, he was like, okay, now this is the most I've ever been paid for anything in my time. You know, this is like basically my first real job.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the school stuff was there, but before that, it was all service industry. Like I had my first job when I was 15, you know what I mean? But it was like lifeguarding and waiting tables and scooping ice cream and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? So this is like, you know, I'm finally inside an organization, and every time I got a promotion, it was like, oh, well, that's cool, you know? Like that, you know, the recognition felt good, but... But then reality would set in and it's like, but the work still sucks and I don't enjoy the job. And I found myself less and less interested in bringing in freelance editing projects or going out on freelance shoots, and found myself less and less interested with the things that I used to be very interested in, camera technology and editing software technology, just getting disillusioned with everything.
So then you hit some wall again?
Honestly, for those 4 years, he was just constantly pushing the wall back inch by inch. Like I was up against a wall almost that entire time. I had we're on iOS 8 now. So this is 4 years ago. What year is that? 2010, I guess, somewhere around there.
That's what the math say.
Yeah, which was about 2 years into this job. I'd still been doing some Apple scripting, and I'd kind of gotten into some Ruby stuff, a little bit of Python stuff.
How did you get into Ruby or Python?
Through scripting, again. I just wanted to do things that Apple script wasn't capable of, so I started looking, and I had this vague awareness of scripting languages as being a thing. I don't remember specifically how. I ended up hitting Python first. Don't remember exactly what led me to Python, but then that led me to Ruby because I just kept hearing about Ruby. I may have this out of order. I may have started with Objective-C before that, which is weird.
But how are you approaching this? I guess you have AppleScript to start with as an analog, and then are you approaching it by saying like, oh, I know that this is how we would do this in AppleScript, and
so
how would you do this in Ruby? You kind of bounce back and forth?
Yeah. I knew basics like conditionals and loops and variables. And most of that early stuff was very, very procedural. And then I figured out how to do methods, not objects, but just essentially functions, and started kind of stringing that kind of stuff together. And then kind of when I did get into Objective-C, so at some point about in 2010, I decided that I was going to write an iPhone app to track beers that you like. So I was getting into beer at the time, and like everything in my life, like when I get a little bit interested in something, I get a lot interested in it. And so I kind of like dove in head first, and I was like, I'm just going to keep a log of every single beer that I drink, and with ratings and tasting notes and everything, just so that I can learn beer culture and get into beer.
I think this is a theme also. Like I think having a kind of passion toy project that you are interested in is a great focusing tool for learning to be a developer. For me, I had a book recommendation thing I was working on with a buddy, and that was a nice focusing tool to go back and forth from manuals and tutorials and things like that, which are a little bit rote, and maybe you're building a Twitter clone or a blog, or I don't know what the analogous application is in iOS development. And then I could go back and apply that to the toy project.
Yeah. No, I think that's exactly what I was doing. You know, the kind of hello world kind of thing for an iOS project is absolutely some kind of catalog app. Hmm. You know what I mean? I need to add new things to a list and I need to add details to those things. That's a very, very common, very, very simple problem to solve. Not simple problem, but it's kind of the base level problem to solve on iOS. So luckily, like, you know, that's the basically the app that I decided to build. So I had started looking at tutorials online and trying to figure out this weird language that's the first real language that I'm learning, you know what I mean? Because I'm basically coming in a little bit of JavaScript. Maybe I had touched Python. I don't think I had gotten into Ruby at that point. But and then AppleScript, you know what I mean? Just jump straight from that into Objective-C and having to teach myself about pointers. And we didn't have Arc, so it was all manual memory management. And
Lord.
Yeah, just right in the deep end of the pool with this stuff, you know what I mean? And like,
it's worse than the deep end of the pool. It's like the pool opens up into the ocean exactly. And then there's a riptide that pulls exactly. you like yeah. a mile out to sea.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, so just trying to learn. And Xcode, this isn't when it was Xcode 3, and so it was like Xcode and Interface Builder were broken apart into two different applications, and it was like a whole, it was a nightmare, honestly. Looking back on it, I'm very surprised that I stuck with it. You know what I mean?
Are you on your own at this point? Or like
completely in a vacuum.
You don't have other people around you in Watch City, Waltham to do iOS stuff with?
I don't know a single other developer. Not one. Like, period. Not online, not in person. None of my friends know what the hell I'm talking about. Like I said, it's all just magic to them.
Sure.
One of my friends actually said that to me at one point. He was like, I think what you're doing is awesome because as far as I'm concerned, everything you're doing is just magic. And I didn't know that like people could actually do this stuff. I thought it just kind of appeared.
I think that's something that's really common as well, where I think you can see other jobs in other industries. I listen to a lot of podcasts about comedians like Mark Maron's podcast. And oftentimes when they sort of tell this journey story, and at the beginning, it's they always look at comedians and go, oh, I love comedy, but that didn't seem like a job I could do. Like, there's another job that exists on this other island, but there's no bridge between you and that.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're slaving away, you know, and this is in your spare time, I assume.
In my spare time, and the funny thing that started to happen was I found myself blowing off my actual work in order to sneak in more time on the iOS stuff. Like, I even at one point pitched an iOS app to my company. We're a video company, you know what I mean? So the iPhone was now going into its fourth generation, and I thought we should have our own iPhone app where you could pull up all of our videos and user-submitted videos on our this wacky social network thing, because everyone has a social network thing. And so I thought that would be a good thing for the company to have, is like a mobile presence and a presence on iOS where you could view videos and stuff like that. So I mocked up a very simple like RSS reader application for them, pitched it to the company. You know, I say company, it was like literally seven people. It's not like, you know, we were some big corporation. My boss was two doors down or whatever.
And you're already the like tech genius in the whole company. So
right. I was running all the servers. That was actually interesting. I mean, at that point, I think we had somewhere in the neighborhood of 150 terabytes of network storage, huge fiber network going through all these editing offices.
Jeez.
And so I was like the de facto sysadmin for all that stuff too, which really sucked.
I wonder if that's how all sysadmins end up in that role.
Yeah, just they're doing something else, but they happen to know more than anyone else. And so,
they just, you know, in their office under the stairs.
Yeah. And then 10 years later, they wake up and they're like, ah, crap, I'm a sysadmin, aren't I? So I'm the de facto sysadmin. I'm already kind of like the tech nerd in the office.
Does it occur to you at this point that this could be a job that you do?
Mm-mm. No. I kept this story in my head about what development actually looked like on a day-to-day basis.
And
the story that I told myself was basically office space, you know, sitting in cubicles, being told write this code now. And then you sit there.
Fix the Y2K problem.
Yeah, and then you sit there and you type out. Like, I remember having conversations about this with my parents, and they're like, you know, you're really, you know, you're fairly good at this stuff, and you seem to take to it pretty well. Maybe is this something, you know, just kind of they're trying to gently nudge me. This is, you know, further back when I'm floundering like an idiot in Texas. They're like trying to gently push me over to programming. And I kept saying, like,
I don't want to work for that Lumberg guy.
Yeah. I'm like, I specifically remember saying things like, oh, well, you know, if I'm going to build something, I want it to be something that I want to build. I don't want a job where I have to build things for other people. Right.
Sure.
I don't want to build other people's ideas, because my whole concept of that was just like, seriously, sitting in Cube Farms, typing out, I don't even know what I assume people were typing out. So I told myself this story that programming was just a hobby for me and that my passion was film. Right. Mm-hmm. This is a story that I just tell myself consistently over the 6 years. Programming is a hobby. My passion is film. And meanwhile, like, I'm continuously trying to bring more development into my day-to-day life. I'm constantly reading about it. I'm constantly, like, looking into the tech sector specifically, like, just reading about technology, you know, new iPhone, new Android, whatever I was into at the moment. Now I'm writing this iPhone app, trying to pitch them another iPhone app. I started writing more Ruby scripts and applications for the company, so... You know, they were doing all this image resizing. So I wrote a small Cocoa app, you know, Mac application that did all their image resizing for them and was scalable. Like, you could add new clients to it and remove them. And it was like kind of nice. And then I wrote like a batch file renamer.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, batch file renamer Mac application. I did that one in Mac Ruby, actually. So I wrote that one in Ruby.
Nice. I did that in Perl a long time ago.
Nice. It was a horrible idea to do in Mac Ruby because that just broke with it. At that point, Mac Ruby required like basically hacking Xcode. So every time you upgraded Xcode, it broke like you couldn't build your software anymore. That was it. You're done. You had to like rehack Xcode. It was a nightmare. And to their credit, like, they were letting me do these things. They were saying, I was saying, hey, I want to spend some time working on this thing that was not video editing and had no bearing on the company's bottom line, except for the fact that I knew that I could speed up the process of doing some things.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I walked down the hall one day and I realized that everyone was just sitting in front of Excel, like three people in the office. And this is like the second day running that this was happening. They were sitting in Excel. What were they doing? Oh, they had like Finder open in this window and they were writing stuff in an Excel spreadsheet, right? In another window.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, what the hell are you guys? Yeah. I was like, what the hell are you guys doing? They're like, oh, we need to create a catalog of all of these video assets because we're going to try to sell them because we shot our own video of our own cars, right? So like I said, 150 something terabytes of car footage that, you know, that's a really valuable asset for someone in this space. Like,
sure.
HD footage that we shot of cars in LA and here in Massachusetts, insanely valuable. And they wanted a cat, but we never cataloged that stuff. We did have a naming convention so that you could look at a name and you could see what the shot was based on the name, but there was no index of these anywhere.
I see where this is going.
So they were going through. My boss's idea was just, okay, you three, take some time, you know, and they're just freaking out because it's just, you know, again.
Oh, it's mind-numbing.
It's thousands upon thousands upon thousands of these files, and they have to write down the year, make, model, you know, and then shot descriptions. They have to write all this stuff down in this spreadsheet, and I'm going like, you know, this is insane, right? I was like, give me like, I don't know, 2 hours. I was like, can I have 2 hours? They're like, yeah, I guess. I was like, don't just stop what you're doing. Just give me 2 hours. And I go and I kind of close my door. And then like 2 hours later, I had this like really rudimentary Ruby script that recursively searched through the footage directories and generated a XML, CSV, actually generated a CSV.
So you can import that back into Excel.
Right. It generated a CSV of year. All they wanted actually was a CSV. They didn't want an Excel. That's just, sure, the program that you make CSVs with.
Yeah, it should be called CSV generator.
Right. So 2 hours later, I came back with this script that had, you know, I was like, here you go. Here's your catalog. You know, it's like, and so I just kept trying to do those kind of things, you know what I mean? And, you know, it wasn't a product that we could sell, but it was so much more efficient. Every one of these things I was doing was just so much more efficient. They were willing to let me, as I saw it at the time, kind of waste my time. Because for me, this was just playing around. I was just having fun. You know, I was just having fun hacking on stuff.
But from their perspective, you just freed up three people's time for
weeks.
God knows how long. Weeks, yeah. I mean, that is from regardless of how skilled of a manager you are, anybody's going to look at that and go, yeah, Gordon, whatever you want to do, keep it up.
Yeah, hugely valuable, hugely valuable. But I'm still kind of going down this career path saying like, no, you know, I'm going to do film editing and this is just play stuff. You know, it's like if I'm having that much fun doing it, it can't be work.
It can't be work.
Like, why would someone pay me to do this? That's stupid. Like, it would be asinine to pay me for this stuff that I just kind of do anyway. That doesn't make any sense. You know, so I was there for 4 years, and I remember just being in the shower at one point and just being like, what the hell is wrong with me? Just kind of had this like, this is all backwards. You know what I mean? If anything, and I really had at this point very little interest in film as anything, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, if anything, film is the hobby here. And, you know, I would consistently blow off film editing in order to work on some script or to work on an iPhone app. Mm-hmm. I never once said, I could work on that iPhone app, but I'd really like to edit this car video instead.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Are you sick of looking at cars at this point?
Oh, horribly sick. I mean, it's okay now. It's been a couple of years, but you know, just I was so because I don't really have an interest in cars, and I kind of had to feign one for 4 years. And then you just inundated with car stuff, and you kind of get used to the jargon, start noticing stuff. And I was so happy when I left that job to just be able to turn that part of my brain off and just not – I was like, oh, God, thank you. I don't have to care about cars anymore. This is great. It's just, again, it's like a whole part of my brain that's just freed up to do other more interesting stuff.
So you have this epiphany. And then where does it – this is sort of epiphany number two where you're like – and at this point, are you like, I need to move as far away from Waltham, Massachusetts as possible?
No. I think I had just gotten married and we were living in Waltham. But I knew that if I was going to actually do this, I needed to actually learn some things because, like, I knew some stuff. But what I knew was all self-taught. And learned in a vacuum, and I was very aware that there were just very large holes in my knowledge. So if anything, I kind of got worse at my job, you know, that I was getting paid to do, just because I just really doubled down and I said, I have this epiphany in the shower, I get out of the shower, I go and tell my wife, I'm like, I have something I want to talk to you about, I think I want to change careers. She's like, really? What do you want to do? I was like, I think I want to stop doing film. I think I want to get into development. She goes, oh, yeah, that makes sense. It's like, for me, this is like this big life-changing moment that I just had, like, lights turned on everywhere, and it was like this big deal. And she was like, yeah, of course. Like, I was the only one. Like, every single one of my friends was like, they weren't impressed at all. They weren't surprised. Like,
right. No one was blown away.
Apparently everyone was like sitting around waiting for this to happen. My parents were like, yeah, no, thanks. Good. Yeah. We tried, you know, years ago, we tried to get you to do this, but
yeah, I had the exact same experience when I switched out of management consulting into trying to be a developer. And I told my family and they said the exact same thing. They're like, well, we tried to talk you into doing this in college. Right. What was with all that science stuff? And I'm like, are you serious? What revisionist history? And it is annoying because everybody's like, yes, obviously.
Yeah.
Why has this not occurred to you sooner?
Right, right.
And you're like, why didn't anybody tell me?
Right. Well, people did tell me. Like, people legitimately told me. Like,
okay.
I had friends, like, when I was writing that beer app, I had friends that were like, you should quit film. And, like, literally were just saying, like, if you quit film and just focus on this, that would not be crazy. And I was like, yeah, whatever. And, like, you know, just move the conversation along. So,
sure.
You know, I don't know. I just didn't see it for whatever reason. I think a lot of it is it gets down to like imposter syndrome stuff, which, you know, I was doing these things, but everything I did, I convinced myself somehow that it was well, obviously this is bad, or obviously it's not real. Like, what I'm doing isn't real development. You know what I mean? Like I said, that whole story I told myself when I was kind of learning initially that, well, all I'm doing is kind of gluing these two things together. That's not interesting. That's not important. Anyone can do this, right. You know?
Would it have helped if you had interacted with any other iOS developers at this
point? Hugely.
Like, just to go meet up and have a coffee?
Yeah, massively. I don't think I had any awareness that that was a possibility. I had no awareness of meetup groups. I had no awareness of kind of any of that stuff. And the one I was aware of, Cocoa Heads here in Boston, I was aware of them early on just from podcasts with tech people that I listened to from the area. But I was scared off from going. The story I was telling myself was that, you know, what I'm doing isn't real. It isn't interesting. They're not going to want me there.
Right.
You know what I mean? That was a scary thing. Like, people actually doing this job, like, they wouldn't want to talk to me. They wouldn't want to have anything to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
So I end up, you know, just kind of doubling down. I took a bunch of courses in Ruby, which really helped.
Where'd you take courses?
Pragmatic Studio, like, not in person, like, everything I was doing was on the web. So the Pragmatic Programmers, those guys, they have a video thing, and they released a Ruby course because I liked Ruby. And so I kind of doubled down on learning Ruby, which is ironic given that I ended up back in Objective-C. But I had a very good grasp of Objective-C somehow early on. And Ruby helped me learn, like, object-oriented design, and it got me aware of testing, although I had no idea how to do it, you know. And so doubling down on that stuff helped my overall programming chops. And I was just constantly kind of trying to learn as much as possible. I was going to night classes back at the school that I originally went to for web development. And it was like PHP and MySQL and horrible. It was huge waste of time. Yeah,
I love LAMP stack.
Yeah. And then going on job interviews. Like, I just tried to go on as many job interviews as I could.
What kind of jobs?
Everything. A lot of Ruby on Rails development stuff. If I got in the door, like, I would get relatively far until we get to, you know, just the core competency stuff. Mm-hmm. Just because, like, I still don't know Ruby on Rails. You know what I mean? Like, it's crazy to me that I was looking for Ruby on Rails jobs at that point. But I think it was just, that was a matter of, those were the jobs that I was seeing.
Sure.
You know, I think I would have applied. Oh, I did. I did apply for some iOS developer jobs too. And I got some interviews, and it always came down to an experience level thing, right? That catch 22 about, you know, every job that I was looking at, they wanted someone with a certain level of experience, and I didn't have that experience because I couldn't get any of these jobs that would give me that experience. You know what I mean?
It's one of the worst things about not just our industry, but every industry is.
Yes. Yeah.
It prevents people from getting in, you know, and it's myopic too. I mean, the way that we hire here is really based on your work, but also some vague guess of what your ceiling is or what your trajectory is, and say, you know, this person is not an A+ programmer now. But I can connect two dots and draw a slope and see that they're going to be there eventually or soon.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is not something that most people do, not in our industry or any industry.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've told people as recently as, like, last week that I was talking to on Twitter. Someone was talking about a job, and they said they were like, you know, I'd apply to that. Except for that they say that you need 3 years of experience. I was like, screw that, man. Apply. Like, just apply to that. Like, what's the worst? And this is kind of the stance I had to take with myself when I was kind of doing this, was like, what's the worst that's going to happen? The worst thing that's going to happen is I'm not going to get that job, which is exactly where I am now.
Right.
So that was kind of my approach to looking for jobs, was I was going to be very picky about where I was going to work. Mm-hmm. I would refuse to apply to big corporations or anything that I viewed as, like, that kind of office space kind of scenario.
Right.
You know what I mean? I refused to go backwards in that way. I wasn't willing to make the sacrifice of having a job that I enjoyed for being in the field that I wanted to be in.
Now, are you at this point feeling encouraged? The fact that you're getting interviews start to get put a little wind in your sails?
Yeah, Both. So yeah, it was encouraging and deeply, deeply depressing at the same time because I was meeting all these companies and meeting all these people and I was getting along with everybody. Like I remember one job interview here where I got all the way. I paired for a full day at the company and ended up, you know, having beers downstairs at the bar with the owner of the company. It was like a little consulting shop here in town. I'm having beers with the owner downstairs at the bar, and then I still don't get that job. And it's like, obviously, like my personality isn't an issue. It's just my knowledge level and my experience level. And it's like it was frustrating that I couldn't seem to catch up.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
So you can see within reach is the thing that you want, but it's just out of reach.
Inconsistently out of reach. You know what I mean? And I tried to stay positive and I tried to take every single interview that I made it that far in as a learning opportunity.
Right.
You know, so that one specifically, I got crushed. The company used Vim. And I got it crushed me like it was horrible. Like
Vim
I was
is
just,
merciless.
I was flat. Well, and it was worse because one of the guys I paired with, he was using Vim inside Tmux with custom key bindings, and his latency turned way down. And I couldn't touch type at that point.
Yeah, that's so me, by the way. That horrible person is also me.
Oh my God! Though I was just like, I was
sorry,
like,
everybody.
It was just so demoralizing because I felt like I couldn't even show whether or not I knew how to write code because I spent all my time fighting with the tools. You know what I mean? But I left that job interview and I immediately started teaching myself how to touch type, and I immediately threw away TextMate and Sublime Text. I just threw them in the trash and installed Vim and was just like, you're using Vim now, you're touch typing now, that sucked. I don't want to do that again. So, you know, take that and learn from it.
Well, one thing I've seen just in hearing the story so far, there's a lot of grit involved. Like there's a lot of, well, I'm just going to fight through it, or I'm just going to force myself to do this thing.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's a character trait, but also it's like a behavior that you learn.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't know. I have a fairly obsessive personality, like I said earlier, and it helps and it hurts, right? Because there are things that I get very interested in, like very, very, very interested in for a very short amount of time. And it looks like this is a thing that I do, and I internalize all these things as well. You know, so like, you know, film editing or the bartending school is a great example of that, right? I was like, bartending, this is fun. And I like internalized that and I obsessed over it. And then it was just like, okay, that's done. You know, spend some money on bartending school, spend a lot of time there, and then kind of was done with that and kind of closed that chapter and moved on. But when I was doing that, you know, I get really, really into it. And I just spend all my time thinking and obsessing about that stuff.
Maybe the thread is that the things that you get really excited about are things that you really want to do, not things that you feel like you need to do or should do.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's it. Almost exactly.
So you're learning Vim. God bless you.
I'm learning Vim, and I keep going on job interviews, and it got to the point where I saw kind of the writing on the wall, which was that, you know, I needed to take a step back and not reevaluate. Like I wasn't taking a step back in order to look at a different career, or maybe this isn't for me, but take a step back and say, like, kind of collect my thoughts on and my notes on, you know, the past, this has been 6 months that I've been kind of like intensive studying, just like constantly, like all day and all night, reading as much as I could and trying to learn as much as I could. And then going on phone calls and, you know, Skype calls and on-site meetings and just every kind of job interview, whiteboard stuff, like everything. For about 6 months, I was doing all that stuff. And I was like, okay, you know what? I need to double down on this learning again. You know, I really did say, like, I'm going to take another 6 months off of applying to places. I'm going to try to fill these holes in my knowledge base.
Which people are telling you you have in the interviews, right? So it makes sense that you would kind of bounce back and go, okay, well, I am interested in this. I am passionate about this. Now I have a sense of what people are looking for.
And I actually explicitly asked, I don't think most people do this, and I did, and I got good results from it, and I don't care if they considered it rude or sometimes I didn't hear back, but I was never surprised, honestly, deep down, when I didn't get these jobs, it never was like, that's shocking. How did I not get that job? Because it was always, again, imposter syndrome. You know what I mean? I never deserved any of the jobs in the first place, so why would they give them to me? So when I didn't get the jobs, I said, you know, always was like, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really appreciate you giving me the opportunity. This is something I really want to do. This is something that I'm dead set on doing this as a career. Can you help me? Like, what are things that I need to focus on? Like, what are things that didn't get me the job? You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And if it's just experience level, like, that's not something I can fix.
Well, it's not a satisfying answer, and it's not actionable at all.
No, it's like, okay, I can't do anything with that. But
there's no time machine handy, right?
Yeah, I did get a number of responses back. They were like, well, you know, when we asked you this and you said this, that showed your lack of knowledge because of this. You know what I mean? It's like, cool. There's a thing that I can go and I can study that. And I can, next time when I go for that interview, that won't be the reason.
Right.
You know? So I had a number of these things in my head. Testing was a big one, better OO design, these things that I wanted to get better at. So I was like, I'm just going to take a step back and focus on learning that and then try again.
Right.
Basically. You know, so I make that decision and then randomly get an email from Chad Pytel, our CEO, through Stack Overflow Careers, because I had just randomly updated my Stack Overflow career profile like 2 days earlier to add some like open source stuff that I was playing around with. And so I had like Ruby stuff on there and Objective-C stuff on there. And so he messaged me about that, and then I started interviewing here. And it was just kind of this random, like, I knew who Thoughtbot was. I was listening to Giant Robots podcast, and it was like, I just made this decision to take 6 months off of applying. And then I get an email and it's like, hey, this is Chad. I'm the CEO of Thoughtbot. I was like, what is happening right now? Like, this is just kind of the, you know, it was very lucky on my part. But it goes back to what you were saying about our hiring process, and that, you know, you kind of try to buy low a little bit, you know what I mean? I mean, not in a actual monetary sense, but like,
well, less buy low, like to trying to get a bargain, but more to predict, you know, you can, after years of doing anything and interacting with other people, you can spot character traits and abilities, and just even just through a conversation or pairing with somebody, you can tell where someone is. That's patently obvious right away, but also what their aptitude is to learn and get better. I mean, I think Stack Overflow is an interesting positive signal of this. Were you as active on Stack Overflow as Mark was?
Oh, not nearly. I'm active, but like I'm in the hundreds, not the multiple thousands.
Well, either way, I mean, it's a question and answer site where you're engaging in a community where you're trying to help other people, but you're also always in there, at least I am, trying to find answers.
Right.
And there's sort of the low level of fixing the problem that you have right now, but there's also the, what's the best way to do this? And when you find people that are poking at that problem more and more, those are the things that indicate that somebody has what I call a high ceiling. The other thing is like some of the things that you're talking about, like grit, like you kind of just push through the problem. And the last one is always, I think Ben always talks about this, is humility.
Yeah.
Being super upfront with what you don't know and saying like, look, I don't know, but I guarantee that we can figure this out together, or give me a few minutes and I can figure it out.
Yeah. And that was another thing that I was very conscious of in the interview process. The last thing that one of my fears, everything about basically my life comes back to imposter syndrome. But this, like, specifically, like, I had this deep fear of getting a job because I accidentally answered something correctly.
Oh, yeah. Me too.
like they were going to answer and I was going to be like, guess, and they're going to be like, bam, you nailed it. You know,
congratulations. You're now the Monday. President of the United States.
Exactly. And then I'm going to show up on Monday and just not have any clue what to do. So I wanted to be very upfront with all these people because that was an actual fear that I had.
I had the same one.
Which, again, in hindsight, like, that's a ludicrous fear. You can tell when people are guessing at stuff. You can tell when people are like, fairly certain he's just repeating stuff back to me that he heard somewhere, not that this is something he's internalizing and actually knows.
Well, it's ludicrous now, right? And when you interview people, it seems obvious, like, oh, you can tell this or that. But I mean, I had this experience when I was an apprentice at Thoughtbot, where every night I would go home and be like, you know what? they're going to realize that I have no idea what I'm doing and I'll never be able to do this job, but I should squeeze everything I can out of it today and tomorrow and the next day until I figure it out. So I took this sort of like upbeat upbeat version of imposter syndrome, which is
that was,
like,
that was my first 6 months at the company. And that was the entire hiring process for me. Was like, Chad emailed me, and so then he was like, I'd like to see some code for a review. And so I sent him this beer app that I was doing, and I specifically said, please don't look at Master. Please look at this other branch. And it was Goose that reviewed the code, and he absolutely just looked at Master. Like, apparently that just didn't come across. So I get on this call with him where he's doing code review, and it's immediately obvious that he's looking at what I at that point had considered bad code, which was, you know, even the code that I was showing, like if I'm looking back on it now, was horrible code. At that point, I thought that what he looked at was really bad, right? So I'm like, well, this is done. You know, it's like, this is as far as I'm going to get here. But I go through the whole call and, you know, try to be upfront and, again, upfront and honest about what I know and what I don't know and answering questions about my code. And we end the call. I was like, well, that was fun, but that's the end of that. You know, there's no way they're going to call me back again. And then all of a sudden I get a call back, and it's like, or an email, and it's like, hey, you know, we'd love to have you come in for a non-technical interview. And I was like, weird, but okay. I was like, okay, idiots. Cool. Yeah. I was like, I guess I'll go meet Chad and I'll see the Thoughtbot office. That'll be fun. You know, so I come here and I talk to Chad and leave there. And I was like, well, that was cool. You know, I'm glad I know where this place is and I'm never going to be here again. And then I get another freaking email and they're like, we'd love for you to come back in to pair with Goose for a day. And I'm just like, what? Like, why? Like, why? Like, I couldn't see it at that point. You know what I mean?
Did you consider advising them not to?
Yeah. Like, well, no, I had this whole backup plan. When I was positive, like the entire step, I was like, well, they keep bringing me in, but at some point they're going to realize that I have no idea what I'm doing. And when they
you're
do, they're
going
to say
wearing the tie at the computer.
Right. Exactly. And so once they realized this, I had this backup because I knew about apprentice.io, right? I knew about the apprentice program. So I was like, I had this whole plan about, they're going to say no, and then I'm going to say, bring me on as the first iOS apprentice. And then they're going to say, yeah, that's a great idea, because that's what I felt like I needed, was 3 months of just, like, let me learn not in a vacuum. Again, up until this point, like, these are some of the first developers that I've ever talked to in real life.
Aside from the interviewing that you'd been doing before that.
No, that's what I'm saying. Once I started interviewing, that was the first time I had actually spoken to other developers. You know what I mean? Like, this whole process is very new to me. I'm 6 months away from meeting my first developer ever, you know? Wow. And so all I needed was like just a little nudge in the right direction, some help with that. And then they ended up, you know, I just ended up getting the job. And so it was like my first 6 months, I don't even think, like, we do quarterly reviews, and I think my first quarterly review just got skipped, and I was like, that's fine. Like, I'm okay just, like, kind of flying under the radar for now. As long as I'm not getting fired, I'm totally happy, you know?
Right.
Because I was positive. It was like I didn't sell my – I had a laptop, like a 2011 MacBook Pro. And I was just like, well, I can't sell that yet, because when they fire me, I'm going to have to give this one back. And then what am I going to do? I'm going to have to fall back to this one.
Right.
But it worked out.
Yeah. Worked out pretty well. It's a good story. Looking at past Gordon, at some point, what would you have done differently? It sounds like you would have met other developers in person at some point.
Yeah, when I started this process, I would have, again, with hindsight, I didn't know that imposter syndrome was a thing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, knowing about imposter syndrome and knowing that that's just kind of...
Everybody has it.
Everybody has it, and that's kind of how everybody feels. I would have been less reluctant to try to reach out and try to meet new people and try to learn more in person. Mm-hmm. I think that's huge. I think that, like, going to meetups, going to project nights specifically are huge. Like, we do NS Coder night here at the Boston office, and, like, it's always 2/3 people that are brand new to iOS development or just trying to learn. And I wish I had that experience when I was trying to learn, because you can sit down with one of these people that's obviously been learning in a vacuum just like I was, and you can go, like, okay, nothing that you're doing is technically wrong, but you can do all these new things instead because documentation gets out of date and tutorials are teaching you the wrong thing. And, you know, there was a guy here last night that had retain and release statements all over his code because the tutorial, he didn't know what they meant, but the tutorial he was following was written pre-ARC and so had manual memory management. So he just wrote them in and then it wouldn't compile. And he was like, why the hell not? You know, not learning in a vacuum would have been enormously helpful to me.
I think understanding that everybody has imposter syndrome and also that mostly developers are helpful to other developers.
Yeah. I mean, especially like
that they're not going to look down their nose at you and go, oh, my God, what a moron. Well, maybe some of them are. But for the most part, people are out there to help you.
Right. And enjoy helping. I think a lot of developers enjoy teaching, enjoy helping. I don't think there would be an open source community if that wasn't true.
Totally.
You know what I mean? Everyone would keep their stuff to themselves if people didn't like helping.
So what advice would you have for somebody else in the same boat or similar boat?
Try to make connections. Try to meet people in the community that you want to be in and apply to jobs. Don't worry about whether or not you can get it. This is kind of every field, I think. I think it's important to just apply to jobs.
I totally agree.
Because, like I said before, the worst thing that's going to happen is you won't get the job. And that's no change from where you are now. But what will happen, you'll either get the job and that'll be great, or you'll learn something about yourself in terms of something that, like a hole that you need to fill and something that you need to get better at in order to get a job.
And on top of that, I had this experience where I think you get better at interviewing. Like I, after grad school, had no idea what I wanted to do. And so I just started applying for every job.
Yeah.
Regardless of whether I was a fit for it or not, some of them were way out of my league. Some were I was way overqualified. But by the time I got through 20 or 30 of these interviews, I had my story down pat for who I was, what I was interested in doing, and kind of explaining who I was and what value I was going to bring to whoever I was interviewing with. And you just get more comfortable, too. You're not sweating profusely, needing to bring new shirts in with you.
Right.
And I think that that's also valuable. When you are doing all this interviewing, you're just getting better at interviewing. It's just like anything else.
Yeah, it's a skill.
Well, I think that's all I had in terms of questions. It was a good story, and I'm glad to have you as a colleague. I mean, I think that this kind of stuff really does encourage people to fight through whatever it is that they're doing right now and find something else that might be more interesting.
I hope so. And I also understand that like it is easier said than done, right? Like it's very easy at this point to just say, just go apply for jobs and see what happens. And, you know, but I think it actually can be that easy to a certain extent. Like I think if you just put your mind to it and you just kind of do it, you know, stuff will happen. It'll be good or it'll be bad, but
totally.
Next time on Reboot, I'll be talking to product designer Brenda Storer. Brenda started out as a psychology major and waitress in California before moving to New York City right after 9/11 and finally throwing away her waitressing shoes to work as a web designer. Today's show was produced and edited by Tom Obarski. Our theme music was produced by Don Okuda. Show notes could be found at rebootshow.fm/1. Thanks for listening.